This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. Coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Lewis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. On this week's This Irish American Life, I do want to pick up the second half of our wonderful interview between myself and Professor Kimberly DaCosta with Vice Chancellor Sir Hilary Beckles, the 8th Vice Chancellor of the University of West Indies. He's really given us a tour de force in terms of the Irish experience in Barbados and in the rest of the West Indies, Caribbean, and into the Americas and the colonial relationship with Britain. We will finish that out. But I do want to give a shout out this week to the Dean of Irish Radio. I'm speaking, of course, of Adrian Flannelly. I want to give Adrian a special welcome and to congratulate him on behalf of everyone in the NYU community, and humbly and deeply from myself personally and professionally and in friendship and in admiration and in mentorship, to congratulate Adrian on his awarding of a presidential medal from President Michael D. Higgins. There is a celebration this week in Ireland, in Áras an Uachtaráin. This is a tremendous honour. Only a very small number of people globally are singled out in this way every year. The competition is stiff, and it's, you know, people from all over the globe, from all walks of life. But I can think of few more worthy people to represent some of the best of Irish traits of collegiality, community and giving. This Adrian has done over 4, 5, maybe 6 decades. I'm aging you now. Maybe that's a little bit too many, Adrian. You'll be sure to pull me up. But for a long period of time, he has enhanced our community in Irish America, in Irish New York in particular, and those connections back to Ireland, which he maintains so strongly. And to mark that, I just want to share, I've shared it a number of times, I'm overdue actually doing a new interview with him, but I want to share the first 15 minutes or so of an interview I conducted with Adrian in 2015, which was marking the first anniversary of us collaborating with him in what was then called the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, which is now This Irish American Life. If you haven't heard it before, this conversation with Adrian gives a sense of his professionalism and why he is a wonderful recipient of the Presidential Medal. We will be all celebrating and championing and raising our glasses to you this week, Adrian, as you go through the formality of celebrating this award. So, as I say, we'll pick up the first 15 minutes or so from an archival interview I have with Adrian Flannelly from 2015, and then we'll pivot to our interview with Sir Hilary Beckles. Gorgeous. Congratulations, Adrian, and Áine, and have a wonderful celebration. And let me share this little snippet from the archive. Congratulations again, Adrian. We're so proud of you.
Am I correct in thinking it's been a while since I looked at some of those sources? I don't, of course, have the command that you have, but in the late 17th century, and maybe I'm sensing it from those, the slave code and the code for the indentured servants. Am I correct in thinking that you get indications as well that the English are trying to separate the Africans and the Irish, and or invoke some sense of the Irish policing the Africans? Am I correct in thinking that as well, or am I oversimplifying things?
Well, in effect, in the second half of the 17th century, when the Africans became the majority and started an anti-slavery culture of persistent rebellion, the Irish were always caught up in this, or were alleged to have been caught up in it. From time to time, they found evidence that the Irish had played a critical role in the planning of black rebellions and the provision of weapons and helping with moving information between the plantations. And the Irish were seen as the enemy within. There is no doubt about that. They were the enemy within. They were not allowed to serve in the militia. They were not allowed to serve in regiments. They were not allowed to play any role in the military or the management defense of slavery, because they were seen as being either in sympathy with the Africans or in solidarity with them. And thus, in all of the aborted rebellions towards the second half of the 17th century, in every instance, a group of Irish people were convicted for participation in one way or another. Now, but importantly, back in Ireland, the experience of the Irish in Barbados was well known. Knowledge of Barbados and the Caribbean, knowledge of what was happening to the Irish, was popular knowledge in Ireland. And thus, the notion that to be sent to Barbados is the worst possible destiny an Irish could imagine. So we have two descriptions. We have a description by a slave trader in West Africa who said that the Africans have a conception of Barbados as a place worse than hell. In other words, the Africans back in Africa, the information was getting back to Africa about what was happening to these people in Barbados. And so the slave trader gives us this description out of West Africa, that the West African people knew what was going to happen to them when they were sent to this place called Barbados. And likewise, the Irish people in Ireland also had a conception of Barbados as a place worse than hell. So to be Barbados, which was the phrase that was used, that Cromwell had initiated. And we all know of the Cromwellian savagery in Ireland and the way in which that war reflected an attitude of ethnicity. Barbados was at the center of the Irish experience, because Cromwell said, don't kill them. Don't kill them. We need them on the our plantations in Barbados. Barbados them. So it was a punitive colony, a place where you were sent to be punished, to die, to be worked to death. And that legacy was embedded in the popular culture of Ireland. And I think what actually happened in the end was that Barbados became a symbol of English power in the Atlantic. These slave owners, these rich merchants and sugar planters who were knighted by the royal family for their success, and this aristocracy of Barbados slave owners. You know, they came out to Barbados, relatively modest capital capacity. By the time they left Barbados, they were not only some of the wealthiest men in Europe, but they were receiving aristocratic honors by the royal family, and therefore they became part of the new governing elite of England. So, as you know, we are still trying to adjudicate that history today. The conversation in England at the moment about Richard Drax's ancestor came to Barbados with £50 in his pocket in 1647 and said, "I am not going to leave this island until I am one of the richest men in the world." And wow, he bought some plantations, he bought lots of Africans, he made a fortune, he became the richest man in the colony. And today, his ancestor sits in the British House of Commons. He's the richest politician in the House of Commons because all of that wealth has come right down to him. And he is now he's the wealthiest man in the Parliament, in the House of Commons, the lower house. And he still owns the plantation that was built in the 1640s. That plantation is still owned by him. And the magnificent mansion that was built on it in the 1650s, which was the largest and most prestigious of the mansions built by a slave owner anywhere in the hemisphere, Drax Hall, Great House it was called then and is still called now, and that house was the symbol of the power of slavery built by the slaves. That house is still owned by him today, and it's still here. So 300 years, the plantation, the mansion, is all there intact, owned by the descendants of this man who arrived and made a massive fortune from slavery. So this is not ancient history. This is contemporary history.
Well, you know, your example and everything you've been talking about brings up this question of the ongoing legacies. And there's two ways, or many ways, but I'm thinking of two right now, that this has been sort of in the ether of late. One, in terms of the resurrection of this Irish as slaves narrative being used for particular political ends in contemporary political discourse in some way to sort of minimize the reemerging dialogue of, you know, black humanity, full citizenship, police violence, etc. But also the question of reparations, you know, the centrality of racialization as a feature that facilitated through not only the commodification of bodies, but the production of that surplus profit that has redounded to certain individuals, as you described, but more broadly that debate about, well, for certain racialized groups, much more than others. And I know that's a big sort of feature of the kinds of debates that you're currently embedded in. I guess I'm curious in what ways you see the importance of continuing and deepening the conversation, connecting these histories, not just, well, all politically in our current, public sphere debates, but also within Caribbean studies and Irish studies, in which, you know, it's kind of surprising in some ways, but not in others, the ways that much of the scholarship is still pretty siloed, either in disciplinary context or even sort of area studies. I'm curious, maybe I've thrown out a lot there, what you might have to say to any of those observations.
Well, I think it's important to pull together all of the strands and assemble them as you would a jigsaw puzzle. Pull all of the strands together. And Europe had moved away before colonization in the New World. Europe had moved away from enslaving their own people. There was a movement away from that in the late medieval years. Well, you know, we all read the mayor of Casterbridge and how he treated with his wife at the moment of colonization. But Europe was moving away from the notion of enslaving your own kind. And we see this across the continent. So the English would have arrived against the background of that. And this is what the Cromwell intervention was about, that we have stopped enslaving our own kind over the last 200 to 300 years. We can oppress them, of course. We keep them landless. We screw the labor out of them. All of that, of course, no doubt. And they must know their place. The workers must know their place in the social order. There's no mobility. There's absolutely no upward social mobility. So even if you made money as a working class person, as a white person, even if you made money, you were not allowed honors. You were not allowed into high society. You know, you were just locked out of that despite your wealth. So they arrive and against that background. But then capitalism kicks in. When an investor that has either lost money, as many of them did in the Civil War, they lost lots of money, or they want to make money for the first time because they see an opportunity for mobility. An investor in a frontier environment, and you have to take significance around the word frontier. What is the nature of the frontier? A frontier is a place where laws either don't apply, laws are flexible, rigidity is converted into flexibility, and you're making up some new relationships for the first time. So out there on the frontier, the Caribbean was the frontier, and some new provisions were coming into being to enable men with capital to accumulate wealth at a phenomenal rate. It was an unprecedented opportunity. Can you think of any opportunity in the history of Western Europe where there was this opportunity to make massive fortunes in short time? The Caribbean was the frontier that gave Europe this phenomenal opportunity. Europe already had an aristocracy, lots of impoverished workers. What would happen if a group of people make so much money and make a bid to be included on the virtue of their wealth into that aristocracy, to make a plea, to present a gift to the king, to offer the king a massive amount of money and say to the king, in return for this, can you honor me and give me status? Of course, that is what was going to happen. And these people were going to buy their way into the elite with the money they were making. Making money on the frontier. We have a description from a Dutch visitor to Barbados. And the Dutch visitor said the English would enslave their mothers to make their fortunes. And that description cuts right to the heart of the matter. That they would enslave their mothers if they had to take advantage of this opportunity. And therefore, they were prepared to do it. But while they were prepared to do it, there was still the weight of history. No, you don't enslave your own kind. But you can push them as close as you can, but you cannot cross the threshold. And this is why the English Parliament rules that while we understand the need to exploit these workers and make your fortune, don't cross the line. Do not cross the line, because as Cromwell said, if we enslave our own kind, we are men most miserable. So the British Parliament drew a line. Treat them slave-like. But we will not, we the British Parliament, that of course, that always had to approve the laws. The laws came from the colony. They go to the British Parliament. The British Parliament approved them and sent them back. When the British Parliament drew the line and said, men most miserable. And if you read that parliamentary debate, it's the most fascinating emotional display. Some members of the English Parliament, of the House of Commons, were crying in the Parliament. Some of them said, I am reduced to tears when I read how they are treating our own people on those sugar plantations, how they have to work with the Africans, sit next to them, live with them, how they have to live. And they are in tears in the Parliament describing what they have heard. Of course, you know, for many it's crocodile stuff, you know, but the important thing is England had reached a stage where they no longer, when that debate was taking place, they no longer needed white workers.
What's and so then, interesting is the ideological process going on that makes the system continue to proceed as long as you have an other group that you don't consider your own. And to the extent you can elaborate that is important for this to go on.
And I think there in the language and in the practice, they had a very vulnerable group of workers. And that vulnerable group of workers were the Irish. There were no traditions of constraint with the Irish. Because if you examine how the English army carried out those bloody massacres in Ireland, when you enter a space and you massacre people, large massacres, hundreds of people here, where prisoners were just put to death in a summary fashion. You only do that when you are convinced that there will be no reprisals. There will be no reprisals, there will be no consequences. The English people were not prepared to stand up to their government to say, no, 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 don't do that, we won't have it. There was silence or support. And therefore, the Irish were the most vulnerable. And therefore, the English thought that they had a free hand, free of cultural constraints. They had a free hand to take those Irish workers down to the basic level of slavery. And they tried and they wanted to. But because within that Irish group were also a few English and Scots and people who they wanted to separate from the Irish, but because they were all in the same category as indentured servants, it created systemic problems because, as that debate in the English Parliament said, they were concerned of what was happening to Englishmen. They were not concerned with what was happening to the Irish. They were concerned with what was happening with their own kind who were intertwined with the Irish. And if they could find a way to separate them from the Irish, but they couldn't, because the plantation owner on the ground, he has a business to run. I have a plantation to run. I have profits to make. And I'm not going to get involved in the niceties that this one is Catholic, this one is Protestant, this one is Irish, this one is English. I'm not going to get involved in those details. I might recognize them. I will not allow an Irish man or Irish woman to work in my house as a servant. Yes, I will give that to the Scots and the English. But the details of that management were so significant that the market was tending to conflate all workers while the politics was seeking to separate them. And then you had this conflict between the forces of the market accumulation of wealth, and then you have political governance and you want to separate them, but it's proven to be very difficult. And eventually the market took place of that. When I was a graduate student, my dissertation was on the economics of this choice. That was my dissertation, to work through the economics of the choice. And if you're going to work through the economics of the choice between different types of labor, you have to pay very close attention to time. You know, the 1640s, 1650s, the decade. You have to pay attention to what is happening decade by decade. You have to pay attention to comparative price, comparative pricing. You know, you go to Africa and you buy an enslaved African for 25 pounds on the auction block, and you hope to get 7 years of labor out of that investment. But you purchase the work, the labor of an Irish indentured servant for 15 pounds, and you want to get 8 or 9 years out of them. And you are balancing the marginal revenue with the marginal cost, and that is changing from year to year. So what is happening is that the price of Africans on the local market, the price is gradually coming down because of greater supply, and the price is coming down gradually. So that by the time when the British royal family created their own slave trade company, the Royal African Company, which under the chairmanship of King James II, when they formed their own slave trade company to flood the Caribbean with Africans, the Africans were now being sold in Barbados for 16 pounds, down from 30, is now down to 15 and 16. At that stage, the price of indentured servants, how much you got for them in Ireland, is going the other direction. So you see, the price of Irish workers, the shipment cost, the recruitment cost is going up, while the price and recruitment cost of Africans coming down. And then you could see that it was entirely rational to say, let us go fully African, because the cost, because these Irish workers are air. The price is now eaten into our profits. And we can train the Africans to do all the work that they could do. Technical domestic artisan.
Hillary, so, am I correct in thinking the Africans are, or is this, you know, this is kind of thrown around a little bit in relation to Barbados, that the Africans would be more resilient in the climate and conditions anyway, or is there any... Does that bear fruit in terms of what you've researched?
The climatic theory was used by slave owners to justify mass enslavement of Africans. And the climatic theory was used not only in the Caribbean, it was also used in Australia 200 years later. That Africans somehow are more resilient in a tropical environment, and European workers were not. But as in the Caribbean, as in Australia, the climatic theory did not stand up, because the sugar plantations in Australia were driven by white workers. And there were hardly many Africans in the Australian plantation, sugar plantation economy. The European workers were the ones who built that, and it was very effective. So the climatic theory, when tested, certainly did not stand up. What is important was not so much temperature, but who was more resilient to certain kind of tropical diseases. So it's not so much the climate, it's who could survive the malaria, who could survive the yellow fever, who has the greater opportunity to survive these infectious diseases. And that was the issue, because, you know, you had epidemics and pandemics sweeping through these colonies from time to time. And when we look at the demographics of pandemics, we were finding that white workers, black workers, you know, the notion that the Africans had some immunity to yellow fever and the Europeans did not. There's some evidence to show that the yellow fever took a greater toll on Europeans than it did on Africans because of certain forms of historical immunity, we are told. But climate is not a reliable, temperature is not a reliable marker of choice, of labor, nor is productivity.
Hilary, you're being incredibly generous with your time, and I know we need to wrap up. If I may pose one last question. It was actually one Professor Jane Allmeyer gave a really great intervention to open our conference, and I'd asked her if she had any questions she'd like to pose you to you. One of them she had come up with was, how do you feel your work has changed the field? I know that's a kind of a big question, and I know you've written very broadly, but have you any general responses to, I don't know, in particular to the Irish, or situating, you know, the empire is really a key theme, obviously, in what you're looking at, how you might frame a response to that?
Okay. When I started this work as a graduate student, I was a part of a project. My supervisory professor, the late John Saville, was a very prominent British historian of labor migration. And he was the one who gave me the subject. He had produced a seminal book entitled Migration in Britain, which looked at the migration of rural workers into the big cities, the migration of workers from the cities, from the peasant community and the land farming communities into the cities. And he said to me, some of these workers who are moving from rural Britain and mass migrating into the cities, some of them are going on to the colonies. So the cities, the port towns and cities were in many instances a transit point to the colonies. And he said to me, why don't you follow this migration? So I said, fine, you did the work on the rural migration into the port towns and port cities. I will follow those who went on. And that is how I started on this project, to look at the migration of the British working class across the Atlantic. And then, of course, some of that migration was voluntary, but a lot of it was enforced. A lot of them arrived in chains. A lot of them crossed the Atlantic. And also, bearing in mind that some of the ships that were used to bring over the political convicts and the political prisoners and the unemployed poor and vagrants and all of these people who were rounded up by the state and shipped out, many of them arrived in ships that were also used in the slave trade to Africa. And we see this happening again. When slavery is abolished and the British are now shipping the Indian working class poor as indentured servants, the second round of indentured servants, these Indian workers are now being shipped from India to the Caribbean. And the ships that were used to ship the Africans were repurposed and refitted to bring out the Indian indentured servants. So the two ends of slavery, with the white indentures and the brown indentures, and we see the commonality of structures and systems. Now, when I started all of this, I was seen as a bit of an anomaly. It was not seen as having any political or ideological significance. It was just a technical subject, a subject of migration. But my task was to realize that this needs to be fully explained in order to grasp what slavery was going to be all about and how the foundations for slavery were being laid in the context of this system of indentureship and how they intersected and how they evolved and where the distinctions were made and how the politics of this became important, how the economics became important, so that eventually the two systems did not merge. They might have coexisted side by side for a while, but they never really became interlocked, though there were forces to push them into a oneness, and there were forces that were pulling them out of that oneness. So the indentured servitude issue became a site to test what slavery was going to be and who was going to be enslaved and what were the commonalities of the two systems and what were the differences, and to get in between that and to offer a narrative. There was hardly any interest at the time, though there was interest in the economic model, which I developed to explain the choice. And that article was published in the Journal of Interdisciplinary History, where I did a quantitative statistical analysis to explain the economics of that choice. And bear in mind that my discipline was economic history. Mm. I was a student of economic history, and I was expected to look at the economics of situations as well as the historical narrative. So when I wrote the piece on the economics of the transition from servitude to slavery, which showed that this was a market-driven choice, I then had to establish an economic methodology that could explain how the slave owner, as an entrepreneur, as an investor, how he was looking at the issue of labor choice. Now that generated some interest, but I was not the first person to argue that. Eric Williams, in his book, Capitalism and Slavery, had said that the rise of African slavery was more the result of economic forces than racial discourse. Racial discourse became a very valuable tool to justify the choice and to justify the maintenance over 200 years of that choice. So it wasn't the cause, it was a consequence, but that does not mean that there wasn't racism before. But when an investor comes to a colony and buys thousands of acres of land for thousands of pounds and decides to make a commodity, whether it's cotton, sugar, tobacco, make that commodity as cheap as possible, export that commodity to the world market and make a fortune, that entrepreneur is looking at his marginal revenue costs. Yeah. And he's making choices based on profit maximization. And he's not going to carry additional costs because the worker is of a different color. He's looking for the cheapest possible labor system to maximize his profit. He might not do it in every instance, but it is his long-term vision of himself as a profit maximizer. And that framework was useful, and that generated some conversation. But on the whole, I did not think I was making a contribution to ethnic studies, though indeed I knew that it would have significance, and I had hoped that it would have an impact, though I didn't think it was going to have the impact the way it has. And I'm still surprised that that work, which I did 30 years ago, is still being talked about.
Well, Hilary, thank you so much. I know I've said it already twice, but this is a really special opportunity for Kim and I to hear you articulate verbally some of the richness that your scholarship has brought to bear on, you know, these incredibly, you know, significant topics of discussion. I mean, in the American context in particular, bringing us back chronologically and geographically in the way that you do. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Kim. A pleasure. The pleasure is mine, and if I may just add one final comment. After completing my work on the white labor class, I then shifted my focus on enslaved African women. And my next book was really a study of what enslaved African women experienced and how those differences were significant. So, yes, the arc of my research was always going to be looking at groups of people that should be given greater visibility, because when we looked at slavery, we spoke in neutral terms. And my argument was that black women suffered more harm. The plantation slavery system extracted more from the black woman than the black male, and that the black woman was the engine room of the system. And we need to speak of her experiences in unique and specific ways and don't conflate them into a discourse about slavery generally. And that was my second departure. So I always have this notion that you need to get down into the nitty-gritty to see what is really happening and break away from these macro generalizations and go into the specifics of reality.
Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what we're trying to do with the conference, but I think is so needed in our public debate now. Yeah. And your work does that beautifully. It's been so generative and really helpful. And I see it in very ironic ways. You know, its continued relevance says a lot about how far backwards we've gone in some sense with respect to these debates. So I want to thank you again. It's really been a pleasure.
I'm here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in our home at 1 Washington Mews, sitting with someone who, this time last year, I'd find it hard to believe that I would be a year down, that we've been doing the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour for a full year, and I wanted to mark our first year anniversary of being on air by chatting to the person who made this possible, the person who had the vision and the generosity of time and spirit to see Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, as a great medium through which academic broadcasting and educational and ethnic broadcasting on the Irish experience could kind of pass through. Of course, I'm speaking about Mr. Adrian Flanley, someone who is well known in the Irish community and the New York community more generally over, I won't say how many decades, Adrian, but multiple decades. Welcome, first of all, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come in and chat to me today ahead of your own program. A year in, don't be too hard on me, but how happy are you with how the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour is going? Is it... Tell me how it's living up to your expectations of what you
exactly,
hoped you would do.
It's exactly as I had hoped for, as I knew. And by the way, Dr. Miriam Nyhan, happy first anniversary
thank
on radio.
You.
It's great. This is what I had dreamed of for a long year. And knowing... that in this house, Glucksman Ireland House, there is a bottomless pit, a trove of treasure that will be it will be here, and it will be part very very much a part of the history of Irish America. Now, as you present your programs, it is it adds that particular aspect of what I was hoping would happen, is that you are able to present issues of today and have those complement the massive, the great trove of oral archives that indeed has been provided by Glucksman Ireland House. And it is, again, if we go through all of America, or indeed outside of Ireland, there is really a dearth. There is a great shortage, particularly in this day, of a medium where you can actually, you know, present it to people so that they can hear firsthand without coming to this amazing Glucksman Ireland House. There is no other medium that can indeed transmit and make available to everybody what is here, and it's fantastic. It's huge.
Adrian, when Glucksman Ireland House NYU took over this hour on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, you and I both agreed it was kind of an easier, a soft transition, where literally from one week to the next we took over here, and we really didn't make a fuss of that. We didn't announce it formally, and I kind of wanted to use this opportunity for the benefit of our listeners, and indeed for me at this point in time, now that we are up and running and going from week to week with this program. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of your relationship with WNYE and this programming of Irish programming, which you were doing for, what, 4 decades before we took over?
45 years. I started in radio 45 years ago, at a time when I was the new kid on the block. Irish radio had, in fact, played a very, very much a part of the Irish community, the Irish American community, and in fact, Irish radio was very much a part of community and neighborhoods. We found when I came here first that a lot of people who listened to Irish radio, and I should point out that Dorothy Hayden Cudahy and her father before her, the McGurks from Dublin, and for some listeners you will probably remember Terry Long. There were a number of Irish radio programs which existed, and they were very popular, not again just to Irish and Irish Americans, but to you know, the neighbors, to the other ethnic groups, to the Jewish communities, to, and they really sometimes I think that perhaps the other ethnic groups didn't have that much choice, because Irish radio would be blaring throughout the neighborhoods. It was not unusual when I came here, and I did come in 1959, to go through some, not necessarily very Irish neighborhoods, but to go to neighborhoods and to hear Irish music and to hear all of this, and you had to, sometimes have to stop and figure, wait a minute, is that a record that is playing? Is that something? But the Irish music in particular was in the air. because of the time that was in it, there was very little news. From Ireland in particular would usually arrive about a week late. That may be difficult for some people to understand, but we did not have obviously the means to get news live, so most of the news that we would read in the newspapers was a week old, and it would be cost prohibitive on radio at that point to do telephone link-ups or whatever. And so it was radio, Irish radio was very popular here, and the being young and cheeky, I knew that doing exactly what everybody else was doing was not there was not going to be a career in that. But I did feel that a lot of things were happening both in Ireland and here that should be shared with an audience. And I felt that if I started a talk radio program, that surely a great number of people would want to do and would want to continue that tradition from once it got off the ground. And so actually it took a long time for me to find Dr. Miriam Nyhan. 45 years to be exact. It is something that, as I say, it was new territory. Very few people in the beginning thought that it was a good idea. Considering that at that very, during that very period, I was also involved as a musician, and so that I would be playing music with great names at the great band leaders at the time, like Mickey Carton and my dear friend John O'Neill, who's still at the ready if there is a function or a benefit or whatever. So people would meet me at all of these venues, like Gaelic Park and the Irish dance halls around, and say, "You talk too much, you know, and your interviews are too long, and nobody really wants to hear all that stuff." And actually, it took a number of years to try to make that a part of our own history. God knows I love music. I love all kinds of music. But at that time, when I was getting off the ground, I was much more inclined to interview musicians and artists and band leaders to hear their story and how they got into the business to begin with. And that left open another area where somebody would say, you were talking to Tommy Makem for 20 minutes and you didn't let him sing a song. Tommy Makem had plenty of opportunity to sing everywhere else. But the Tommy Makems and Frank Pattersons and the Clancy brothers, they were delighted to have an opportunity to talk about their experiences. So I learned somewhere along the line that if I have one microphone for myself, and if I can provide some microphones for those who have a story to tell, then I would have a fairly easy job, and it has been a great job.
So you were essentially, Adrian, from early on then, you know, collecting oral histories and folklore and asking them about their experiences without, like, that's how we would label it or call it now, but you were doing it kind of instinctively.
Instinctively. And I also found that, looking over the archives, and I've had some very rare opportunities to, to get what were more sound bites than interviews from presidents of the United States, for vice presidents, for ambassadors, and one thing. But when somebody asked me, what was your most interesting interview? I'm at a loss, because I find that all interviews are very interesting. But you have to, in my opinion anyway, if you invite a guest to your program, then it is kind of unimportant whether you agree with your guest or you don't. But you have to let that guest tell their story. Mm-hmm. And you have to respect whatever opinions they have. It's not necessary to say, Jesus, I couldn't disagree with you more. You don't invite a guest into your house and then use that opportunity to, as we say in the west of Ireland, to ballerag them. That's not, that's not what it is.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life, and thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.